Hello and welcome to the first in this special series of three podcasts from CIPR Cymru. Recorded in February 2021 as part of the Global Alliance Ethics Month, these podcasts talk about ethical communications in a post-Trump, mid-COVID and never-ending Brexit era. Open, honest and accurate communication has never been more important, and yet public trust in data and content has been significantly damaged by arguably unethical practices surrounding the perpetuation of fake news. So, what are we as PR practitioners doing to make sure our practice is ethical? And how should we be helping our clients and organisations to rebuild trust in public relations, media channels and public debate? In this first episode, we hear from Ben Verinder, a lead assessor for the Chartered Institute of Public Relations Chartered Practitioner Programme. We ask Ben to open our discussion by exploring how ethics stands shoulder to shoulder with strategy and leadership and why it is fundamental to good practice.
So I've been asked to talk on the following topics: the emphasis and weighting on ethics in the chartered process. Why do we give ethics the same weight as leadership and strategy in that process? And also, more broadly, the relevance of ethics to public relations practice. And in my response, and I'm not got any slides, it's an old-fashioned talk, I've got some props. I'm going to present two very different versions of PR, two very different visions of PR. One that understands public relations to be, by definition, ethical, and one that comes to some very different conclusions based on modern, contemporary public relations, well, historical as well, public relations practice. But I'm going to try and persuade you as a group that whichever vision of public relations you hold, the optimistic or the pessimistic, the conclusion in relation to ethics is going to be the same, that it's essential to practitioners led by those at senior level. Before I start, I want to look at some definitions, and there's a really good reason why. Ethics, as Rian mentioned, there's some tension sometimes with legality. It's not equivalent to legality. Sometimes the legal is unethical, and the ethical may be illegal. So apartheid South Africa, or a British Caribbean colony prior to 1833, or perhaps one might say modern day Xinjiang, nor is it equivalent to permission. Just because something is allowed or even encouraged by people, let's say, in authority. Imagine, I don't know, the President of the United States standing on a podium inciting people to attack a particular building. It doesn't make it ethical. Nor are ethics and morality the same thing, although they're often confused. They overlap, but they are distinct. And this distinction is incredibly important, I think, for the subject under discussion. So I'll give you some examples. A lawyer may think it's his moral duty or her moral duty to ensure that someone she knows to be guilty of murder doesn't get away with it. But if she pointed that out in court of law, she'd be contravening her ethical code. Let's think about you and your practice. Let's think about an extreme circumstance, perhaps. Let's say you're teaching crisis management in a public relations school in London. Let's imagine you've got quite a lot of international clients. Let's imagine that one of those delegates is a member of the Saudi Arabian military. Now, this might sound far-fetched, but actually, the Saudi Arabian government sent quite a high volume of members of its intelligence corps to undertake public relations training in London between 2017 and 2020. Now, let's imagine that this delegate tells you, confesses to you, that they were somehow involved in the murder of Adnan Khashoggi, the journalist. Now, there's no international warrant for the arrest of anybody involved in that particular activity. So this action would not necessarily contravene domestic laws. Now, quick show of hands. All right, let's say, just for say, you've got a friend who knows somebody who's in MI5. A show of hands on reaction, please. Would you, just as a thumbs up or a hand raised, if you had the opportunity, would you inform your contact that what this particular individual has told you in relation to their possible involvement in that murder? I'm just looking at everybody. So we've got a few yeses, quite a lot of noes. Some yeses there. So if you did that, strictly, you'd be breaking the CIPR code of conduct in relation to confidentiality of a client. perhaps, but police matter no, depending on what it's on. So the point being, my point being with that, so thanks for your votes, thanks for your points. The point being is that you may take a moral stance, just like the lawyer, but it might contravene a contemporary code of practice. I think that the distinction between morality and ethics is vital. We'll come back with some more examples that are perhaps a little bit less extreme in a minute. Because the failure to distinguish between, say, personal morality and ethical code is common in public relations, and it causes problems that are closely related to the question at hand. I'll explain why. Morality is often defined as a set of personal values or guiding principles to help us answer the questions, how should I live and what should I do? Perhaps more usefully, it's important to explain that morality is often considered as informal. In other words, it's not, with vital exceptions, usually enforced, although it is often subject to strong social pressures. It's typically inherited and applied as habit. Ethics, on the other hand, is typically it's part of a branch of philosophy, and it's typically expressed in a framework or codified, shaped by values, principles, and purpose in some way. And these aim to help us answer questions like, what should I do in a particular circumstance? And here's the really crucial bit. Ethics typically involves a process of conscious reflection. If I say to you, is it wrong to murder someone? You're back like this. If we talk about ethical considerations, often we are referring to a code or reflecting on a more complex, challenging question. When we see discussions of ethics in PR as axiomatic, when we see assumptions about ethical practice without any discussion, people saying, I'm an ethical practitioner, without appeal to references, when we see people discuss ethics as doing the right thing, as if that were immediately knowable in the way that morality might be to an individual, without further discussion, that's typically a problem, because it's not a given. It's a process of reflection, often in the application or reference to a code, a precept, an act of reference. And that's why it's so important within the chartered process, which is in itself an opportunity and an act of reference. Let me ask you some more questions. Okay, so who's seen the documentary Social Dilemma? Of those of you that's seen that, would you agree that social media platforms are designed to be addictive to the user? And just out of interest, by the way, for all of those of you that haven't seen it, quick show of hands, do you also agree that social media platforms are, by and large, you know, they contain elements that are designed to be addictive to the user? So there's a general consensus on addiction of social media platforms. So here's the next question. If social media platforms are designed to be addictive, is it ethical for a PR practitioner to encourage people to use an addictive platform? Okay, so not a few, thumbs up. Now, I don't know what the answer to this question is, but we can imagine perhaps a future in which platforms might be proscribed in a code of practice because they're addictive. Here's another one for you. Okay, let's take the issue of PR activity and representation. Hands up if you think it would be ethical to take on a client or work for an organization that manufactures and distributes, certain current class A drugs are in the future made legalized, decriminalized. Who here would think it'd be ethical to take on one of those clients, one of those manufacturers or distributors of a class A drug that's currently, okay, so a few people say it would be ethical. So that's a question of representation. In the UK, alcohol misuse is the biggest risk factor of death, ill health and disability amongst 15 to 49 year olds. In Wales, there are around 50,000 alcohol related hospital admissions and 15,000 alcohol specific admissions each year. In Wales, the rate of alcohol specific hospitalisation admissions is 3.3 times higher in the most deprived areas. So One might legitimately ask whether it's ethical to work for an alcoholic drinks manufacturer or any organisation that sells alcoholic drinks, independent of legality. I offer no answer whatsoever to these questions, by the way. I wouldn't presume to. They're difficult, complex questions. I'm just trying to raise them as examples. And lastly, and I'll explain why in a second, who thinks that actions are right or wrong, depending on the extent to which they promote happiness or prevent pain? Who thinks that's not a bad definition of right or wrong? Oh, well, you wouldn't agree with Peter Singer then. So the philosopher Peter Singer, his core definition of what makes an action ethical and unethical. And that's behind his arguments in relation to the fact that we have a moral duty, an ethical duty, I should say, in relation to the pain that we inflict on any sentient being, includes, let's say, a battery chicken or a veal calf or an industrially farmed pig. So again, it's not impossible to imagine a future when we might consider it unethical to work for an organisation that produces or sells meat. My point being is just simply to try and suggest that we don't know how society will develop in the future, and societies do develop and their codes change. Our codes of practice change, whether there are our ethical codes or our professional codes or our sporting codes. So my wife bought for me this very odd book called Fox Tossing, Octopus Wrestling and Other Forgotten Sports. And it's a book about ancient sports that have gone the way of all things and changed. But these sports had their own codes of practice, or they were codified, and they were sometimes sort of sub-sports. So they included walking stick fighting, ski ballet, lion baiting, one-legged cricket, etc. And the summary here is that the reasons why these forgotten sports fell out of favour are, of course, many and varied, but broadly speaking, can be divided into three categories: cruelty, danger, and ridiculousness. So my sort of heavy-handed point is simply that codes change, and that's why we need to refer to them, and that's why we need reference points, and that's why we need to continually be discussing them, and that's why we need prominence in assessments and discussions such as the chartered assessment. What we're looking for in chartered assessment is not just ethics, actually. It is ethical behaviour, understanding commonly accepted standards for professional behaviour, but also recognising and talking through dilemmas. And it gives us an opportunity to identify solutions, you know, to ethical dilemmas like we're going to do today. We're also looking for ethical competence. We're looking for a detailed knowledge of the CIPR, specifically code of conduct, and also to guide others in ethical dilemmas by using that conduct. And we're also looking for understanding of broader legal and privacy issues, such as privacy and libel, slander, defamation, etc. So my first big argument for inclusion is simply that we need to keep going back and checking and referencing ethical codes, because these things move and change. My second, perhaps more familiar argument to you will be that ethics is normative behaviour within most professions. Ethical principles underpin pretty much all professional codes of conduct. They may differ depending on the profession, but they've got commonalities such as honesty, trustworthiness, or requirement for loyalty, respect for others, adherence to the law, doing good and avoid harming others, and accountability. But having a code of practice doesn't make us ethical or moral per se. I mean, an extreme example again, Harold Shipman took the Hippocratic Oath. Nor is PR alone in its struggles regarding ethics. And I particularly want to make this point because I think sometimes public relations thinks it's alone in this struggle. And nor are other industries absolved from difficult ethical challenges or widespread unethical behaviours because they have a licence to practice, unlike PR, and an obligatory code of conduct. Arthur Andersen wasn't a PR firm, neither was Enron. PR did not cause the 2008 crash, but there's a good argument that the behaviours of the banking sector did. So that's my kind of second point. My second argument is that these are common, effective, professional codes, and they bring us, they're normative within professions. Third argument, peer ethical practice is just, all things being equal, more effective, philosophically, theoretically, and practically. So in other words, for PR to be effective, ethics must be embedded in our work. So if we think about the heritage of public relations, those who founded the Institute of Public Relations in the UK believed that improved communication, according to Tim Travis Healy, one of the founders, was a means of improving cooperation and reducing conflict between groups in a post-war society. If you can read one thing on the issue of ethics and public relations, I would always commend it to be Tim Travis Healy's Credo. It's a very short article, very short piece. You can find it on Wadsworth's blog, actually. It's incredibly poignant and powerful. But let's look at theory, you know, broader theory. Poor ethical practice, as Rianne mentioned earlier on, is corrosive to trust. If we do bad things, typically, people stop trusting us. In stronger terms, as Paul, and these are my props, Paul Myrea says, you know, trust requires PR in this book, in his chapter in Chartered Public Relations. Look anywhere for advice on building trust and you'll find it involves integrity, openness, information sharing and relationship building. What better way to describe PR, he says. It's not just that we shouldn't do bad things. We need PR to do good things. Dr. John White, my colleague, goes one further. Society requires PR. PR is vital to society because PR has the essential to build us up in society through communications and relationship development. Anne Cronin at the University of Lancaster, she talks about the fact that we don't actually live in a representative democracy. We live in a commercial democracy, and public relations is vital to that through its role in organizational relationship building. Or let's look at, you know, the Aristotelian view of friendship, as my old colleague Sue Walsenholme used to introduce to me. Three factors in Aristotle's view of friendship: sharing of pleasures, being useful to one another, and being committed to a common good. And the strongest of all these levels is the last one, being committed to a common good. Why? Because the first two are transactional. And we know that transactions can prove weak when pressures are applied. So there's an ethical dimension in friendship building. As A.C. Grayling says, true friendship can only occur between good people. Can we ever speak truth to power whilst being unethical? Do we lose our rights to do that? And ethics involves difficult truths. So it's a PR function would identify through boundary spanning. Ineffective boundary spanning equals reputational damage or risk at best, whistleblowing, etc. If issues are not identified through honest and difficult conversations, then there's going to be consequences. And without serving the public interest, we lose accountability and then we risk losing truth, as John Brown writes in relation to the Right Reverend James Jones's 2017 report on the Hillsborough disaster, and how he described the actions of the South Yorkshire Police as the patronising disposition of unaccountable power. My colleague, Professor Anne Gregory, absolutely spot on when she talks about the collective impact of ethics in a brilliant chapter on ethics, sorry to embarrass you, Anne, in Tension Yeomans, in one of the earlier versions of Tension Yeomans. Apologies, I haven't bought the new one, I should do, what would kill me, that I haven't. The new version of that, which is obviously with Stephen Waddington, and she writes, if you act as a professional, you will eventually be recognized as one. So acting ethically as like other professions with their codes of conduct and their ethical rules means you're more likely to be recognized as a fellow professional. And she's absolutely right. And those codes of conduct help build confidence in the profession's trustworthiness. They provide greater transparency and certainty to clients about how their affairs will be handled. They provide a supporting framework for resisting pressure among practitioners to act inappropriately. They give the profession as a whole a common understanding of acceptable practice, which builds collegiality and allows for fairer disciplinary procedures. And they help others dealing with the profession, such as regulators, because we are seen to be more reliable and easier to deal with. In some ways, codes of practice are public relations tools. That's the thing about ethics. It's typically good PR. And then if you look at practice, just core practice, ethics in the function doesn't tend to work out so well. Sweatygate, Free Q8, Coalition for Vehicle Choice, you name it. Think of any astroturfing activity. You know, typically, when discovered, these things don't go well for the organization involved in them. Bell Pottinger, if you thought about, you know, a campaign to stir up racial tension that posed an existential threat to the organization involved in it. Ogilvy and Mather in 2004, when the employees were found to have altered timesheets and legal action was taken against the organization. I can think some a more recent example being a particular public relations director making negative comments about people from Wales, which I would imagine has not gone down particularly well with Welsh stakeholders, including employees of that particular organization, and that's impacted negatively on important reputations and relationships. On the other side of the coin, think about the positive impact of practitioners doing the right thing around the world, making the right sort of trouble, acting ethically despite difficulties. As Anita Roddick once said, if you think you're too small to make a difference, you've never been in bed with a mosquito. And then, you know, lastly, think about organizationally. If you think about Thomas Cook and the way it dealt with the Corfu carbon monoxide poisonings, or co-ops governance, co-op banks governance issues, or Oxfam related to Haiti, that case study, and the rest, you know, typically when organizations behave unethically, it has a negative impact on their reputation and broader considerations. As John Dawley and Fred Helio Garcia say in Reputation Management, which I, here we go, this one, I do recommend, inattention to ethics risks significant harm to reputation and other intangible corporate assets, including employee morale and productivity, demand for your company's products, confidence in a company's executives, and stock price performance. So here I've argued on a focus on ethics because we need to check we're doing it right, and ethics makes for better PR. But what about the other side of the coin? What if it doesn't? So the age-old question, are we guardians of the public interest, or is our responsibility really to our paymasters? As John White also says, the commercial practice of public relations is the biggest obstacle to the professional practice of public relations. For Robert Phillips, author of Trust Me, PR is Dead, where is it? Somewhere under here. If you haven't bought it, I do recommend it. As a counter argument, PR is at the service of a defunct society. PR people, he writes, true to Edward Bernays' original version, want us to believe in a manufactured reality and forever happy endings. And what better reminder of that than the use of young influencers by British American Tobacco, recently discussed by on his blog by Stephen Waddington, and his question, well, what do we stand for? For Phillips, PR is doing little more than reinforcing the status quo, and Phillips does not like that status quo. For him, we're tangled up inextricably in a society of pollution, corruption, and rabid inequality. George Pitcher describes PR as having developed as a parasite on the body corporate. And Tom Watson describes how publicity has hijacked the majority of PR practice at the service of short-term, sales-led, opportunistic aims. If we're determined by our actions rather than our words, then isn't the nature of PR what the majority of its practitioners do? Sometimes unethical practice doesn't even get punished in public relations and in the wider world. Sometimes it equates to success. Think about Rupert Murdoch and the hacking scandal. For all the impact that happened in relation to News of the World, B-Sky-B deal, regulations in Australia, actually his reorganization and restructuring of his business meant that it was more profitable than ever. Think about Russia's diplomacy strategy in service of extrajudicial assassinations of state enemies. It's working quite well for them, and from a geopolitical point of view, quite right now. And sometimes bad practice doesn't impact productivity or product demand or the bottom line in the way that Helio Garcia and Dawley describe. So if you think about the minimal, relatively minimal impact on VW after the emissions scandal. And sometimes PR practitioners are themselves involved in nefarious activities. So think about the Archimedes Group in Israel, Pragmatico in Ukraine, Katznet in Poland, all companies labeling themselves as public relations, found by a BuzzFeed investigation to be generating disinformation and fake news as part of their practice. And Trevor, I'm sure, later on, and his colleague Simon Goldsworthy, indeed argued that the market forces to which public relations is subject specifically do not reward ethical practice. And then let's think about the State of the Profession survey, of which I've been the author for the last few years, which my team works on, and the common question about the common response that satisfying client requirements is a primary concern and above ethical ones. And as Sue Wolstenholme writes in her introduction to PR, in 1995, Professor Anne van der Maiden of Utrecht University asked practitioners at a major European PR conference if they would resign their job rather than go against what is right. And the majority said they wouldn't resign. They justified this as the right thing to do because their replacement would be someone who behaved unethically and they would be unemployed. But in acceding to something that's not right, weren't they behaving unethically? One thinks, perhaps, physician, heal thyself. And lastly, ethics is really messy. It's confused often with morality and tensions, and it has tensions with legality. It's challenging, it's difficult. So can we really apply ethical codes when ethics is a disputed territory that we've been arguing since we first began to communicate? That the divide between teleology, those that believe ethics derives from behavior, and deontology, that it derives from principles and rights, is no closer to being bridged. I have a degree in philosophy. I specialized in modern ethical theory, and I have, I can't understand the essays I wrote. I have few certainties, many questions, and I struggle often, to come to a decent conclusion. But taking all of these things into account, even if you take the negative view of PR practice, even if we're pessimistic about PR practice, it becomes imperative that the position of PR is to improve. Then practitioners, led by those at a senior level, should be focusing on ethics. It makes the argument to focus on ethics even more important. And the way that we do that is by including it as an element in chartered assessment, or one way we do it. And if you take the more positive view of public relations, then ethics is vital to practice and should be assessed at the highest level because ethical practice is best practice. And whether you take the positive or negative view, the fact that ethics is so thorny and difficult and challenging and hard to resolve is another reason why it should feature in chartered assessment. We desperately need opportunities to reflect, to reference, to discuss. And that's what that element of chartership provides.
Our thanks to Ben Verinder for setting the scene. In parts 2 and 3, CIPR President Mandy Pierce and Ben are joined by our ethics panellists, Trevor Morris, Sutta Singh, and Professor Anne Gregory to discuss the question, ethics is an absolute and inviolate ethos, or is that just plain naive? Don't forget you can log 5 points against the CPD ethics strand on the CIPR My CPD portal for listening to this episode. So, see you next time.